332 days. That was the international statistic of the year in 2020 as identified by the Royal Statistical Society. That was the length of time between scientists publishing the genetic sequence of COVID-19 on the 11th of January and an effective vaccine being administered on the 8th of December. This vaccine was an integral part of the world's pandemic response. Vaccines aren't new. In a World Health Organization report describing the history of vaccines, Dr. Edward Jenner is accredited with the world's first successful vaccine for smallpox in 1796. In the last 100 years, vaccines were developed for yellow fever, pertussis, polio, hepatitis B, measles, mumps, rubella, and more. Well, how do we know vaccines are safe and effective? Why do some people argue against using vaccines? On our show today, Dr. Jeffrey Morris will help us understand these questions and other issues related to vaccines. I'm John Baylor. Stats and Stories is a production of the American Statistical Association, as well as Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film. I'm joined in the studio by my colleague, Rosemary Pennington, chair of the Department of Media, Journalism, and Film. Not in fear. Rosemary Pennington, chair of the Department of Media, Journalism, and Film. Our guest today is Dr. Jeffrey Morris. Morris is the George S. Pepper Professor of Public Health and Preventative Medicine and Director, Biostatistics Division, Department of Biostatistics, Epidemiology and Informatics at the Perelman School of Medicine, University of Pennsylvania. He also has been actively involved in scientific communication efforts on social media and with various media outlets. He is a distinguished research fellow at the Annenberg Center for Public Policy. Jeff, it's a delight to welcome you to the podcast.
Thank you, John, Rosemary. It's great. Yeah, great to be on.
So how did you first get involved in studying vaccines?
Yeah, it was interesting because in my career, I'd never really done much with that. I did most things in cancer research before this, but it was really the pandemic that got me interested in that. In the early pandemic, when we're all kind of stuck at home, locked down, there's this new virus disrupting our lives. We have no idea what's going on. So I just took time to try and keep up with the emerging data and literature to figure out what was going on. And that's what kind of got me involved more in scientific communication. But also then, by the end of the year, the big talk was about these vaccines coming that were hopefully going to end the pandemic, get us back to normal. And so that's what kind of got me interested in vaccines, really the pandemic and the COVID vaccines first.
So, you know, this 332 day thing, that seemed really fast, you know, just to go from start to something that's being applied. Is that typical? How long does it normally take to develop a vaccine?
Yeah, no, it's a miracle they were able to do it that fast because it's very atypical. I think the typical timeline for a vaccine in a non-emergency situation might be 10 to 15 years in a non-emergency, but in a fast track, maybe 5 to 7 years. So yeah, less than a year is remarkably fast, but given the urgency of the pandemic, there were a number of things that were done to enable those steps to be completed much more quickly than they usually would.
Yeah, and I would love to hear more of that because there are a lot of people that I know who have gotten COVID vaccines, but then also are still sort of hesitant around that because of this fear that it happened so fast. Why was it able to happen so fast? And I guess, given that you've been looking at the communication, how do you feel about how it was communicated as it was being pushed through? Was the reason that it was being able to be done fast communicated as well as it might have been? I guess that's my question.
Yeah. One thing I can say is, like, I shared concerns and I was very skeptical initially at first as well, because I was very nervous that it was done so quickly. And one thing, since the mRNA vaccine sort of dominated and the viral vectors to a lesser degree, we forget that really there were really dozens of different vaccines where they tried all at once, but these were the ones that got to the finish line first and got across. So there was just, just a tremendous effort. And so of course, funding and there was funding that is never provided on that scale, you know, under normal circumstances that helped, but just the urgency of the pandemic with it being a novel virus We know people were dying. We know that it was overwhelming hospitals to some degree. So they recognized the importance of it. So they tried to do everything they could to accelerate the development. And one thing that maybe is a misconception is that people think that there were a lot of steps that were skipped and that major shortcuts were taken. And I think that's not really as true as people tend to think, that really there were some steps that maybe were not done as much and steps that were done more quickly, but pretty much the usual steps were followed, but there were some ways they sped it up. Like a couple things. One of the early steps is really identifying the target and developing the actual assay. With the mRNA vaccines, they had a big advantage because once the sequence was identified in January of 2020, the mRNA technology, it's very quick to develop something with a new sequence. And there were a lot of recent work in the years preceding the pandemic, sort of further developing the mRNA platform. A lot of it was in cancer. When I was at MD Anderson Cancer Center, I worked on some projects with some of those vaccines and cancer. And I think some of the technical hurdles to get it to work happened to just be overcome. And so it was kind of ready to roll. So that really sped things up where they were able to very quickly have something ready to work. Then the other thing they did was there's sort of preclinical testing, phase 1, phase 2, phase 3. Usually these are done in a serial fashion with breaks in between, but here they overlapped them and put some of them together. They put the phase 1 and 2 together. They did the preclinical at the same time as the phase 1 and 2. And then they very quickly designed the phase 3 and moved into that. And then once the phase 3 started, phase 3 is typically tens of thousands of patients. It's a randomized trial with many centers. It takes a huge amount of time to organize this, get it off the ground. Usually the accrual is slow, but here they got it off the ground very quickly. There was so much interest that it accrued remarkably fast. And for their primary endpoints for efficacy, they were able to reach those endpoints within a few months. And the results were so positive that they could actually achieve their primary endpoint within a few months. So I think all of these factors led to the ability to develop it rapidly. And then the last thing I think that also sped it up is there's usually a long delay in terms of figuring out the manufacturing. But what happened is they were working on the manufacturing concurrently with the phase 3 trial to work out the kinks so that they could hopefully roll it out more quickly once it was approved. So I think that was another area where the overlap allowed them to go more quickly.
Well, and then, you know, the rest of my question was just sort of the messaging around that, right? And so I think, you know, hearing that and having followed that as it was happening, you know, obviously, like, this makes sense. Like, obviously, you know, no one is going to share a vaccine that's unsafe on this scale. But it did feel like the messaging around why we could move so quickly felt like, for me as a consumer of media, it felt like it did not get communicated as well as it might have. And I wonder what your read on that is.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, I think it probably could have been better. And for my own sake, as I was following it, like as it was going, I heard them saying this. So I kind of nodded my head and I was like, okay, that's how they're speeding this up. But I was still concerned that, okay, are they going to miss something? Is something sloppy? But they probably could have done a better job. But I actually think the bigger problem with communication and maybe some of the things that hurt credibility and trust in some of the public was more not acknowledging the limitations of what they knew at that point. Like there were some things that were very well established from that initial trial, but there was still a lot of uncertainty in terms of more severe outcomes, how well it was gonna prevent severe or fatal COVID, how long the protection would last, would it wane, how well it would work with future genetic variants. And then also, even though the safety data was promising, This is one thing I emphasize in a white paper I recently wrote, is that the phase three trials are never sufficient to really establish and detect all of the potential risks. Because something like vaccines, even very rare risks, are important to know about. And a study of 20,000 per arm is not going to detect a one in 100,000 risk. So I think that there was uncertainty about, okay, there may be some risks from these vaccines, especially with it being a new technology that we don't know about yet. And I think that a lot of those nuances and limitations were not communicated, perhaps in the name of trying to encourage more people to get the vaccine, which to help public health, which might be a good thing. But if it was done in a way that was not transparent about the uncertainties and limitations and risks, I think that's where there was potential for it to backfire. And I think it kind of did.
That does feel like a kind of perpetual problem when it comes to science communication of any kind, is figuring out how to well communicate the issue of uncertainty and explain what that means in a scientific sense versus what it might mean in a non-scientific sense, right? And it feels like in COVID, that issue of like how to communicate uncertainty well that doesn't produce fear and skepticism but is honest just sort of came to a head in this very like urgent crisis moment. And it felt like it was a really potent example of that struggle and the need to figure out how to do that well.
I think that's well said. I think you hit the nail on the head, because I think this is always true, because science is always nuanced. There's always uncertainty. And a lot of times that gets lost in the public messaging, because people that aren't trained to think as scientists, I think it's hard for them to manage the uncertainty. People want to think a little more black and white, like the vaccine works, the vaccine stops transmission, the vaccine will end the pandemic. People want to think that way. The vaccine is safe. But the nuances are always more complex. And we scientists like talking about the nuances, but then sometimes we bore people, or sometimes we confuse people. Yeah. And so that's, I think, why the messaging is difficult. And that's part of why I've gotten involved a little bit in scientific communication and working with media, because I understand the need to simplify the message. But I think we need to do a better job of retaining more of the nuance, more of the uncertainty, and maybe trusting the public to understand a little bit more complicated things than we do. Because I think, and that's part of the teacher in me, that I sort of take it as a challenge to say, okay, this is complicated, but I'm going to get this person to understand it. I think they can, because I think we can relate complex principles in ways that resonate with people and get them to understand it. So that's where I think we can educate the public a little more about some of the scientific, even statistical, epidemiological nuances, so that they can recognize when things are misinterpreted, or they can understand the nuances a little better. So that's something I've tried to do, but I don't know if I'm probably am trying to push it too far in my, you know, my efforts. But I think overall, I think that that's something, you know, we need to figure out how to do better. We have a very educated, informed society, and people can handle being talked to as adults. We don't need to talk to them as children. Yeah.
You know, just as a as you were talking about that, I found myself thinking about different types of literacies, whether it was scientific literacy, data literacy, statistical literacy. You pick your favorite one. And just this, the story that you mentioned this, the question about, well, you know, how long does a vaccine's effectiveness last? And, you know, yeah. I think that there's, I can well imagine the confusion of saying, oh, I was vaccinated this as a kid, now I don't have to do it again. Or I was vaccinated recently and I don't have to do it for another 7 years. And the idea that you're starting out with something for this recent disease and you go, well, you know, I have to do this again in 6 months, or I have to, you know, there are these kind of challenges to try to process the fact that with certain diseases and certain kind of interventions for them, they don't all just work the same. So that's a hard story to tell.
I think it is, because I think people think vaccine, is something you get as a child and you have lifelong immunity and you're not going to get to the disease. And, you know, and that's a little bit simplistic. And I think for certain types of viruses, even if you get infected, like, and this is true of SARS-CoV-2, if you get infected today, you have some immune protection once you recover. So that's great. But you might get COVID-19 again in less than a year. So like that protection doesn't last the rest of your life. It might only last a year. So why would we expect vaccines to somehow be permanent if the infection itself does not provide permanent immunity against reinfection? And when we have viruses that mutate quickly and that spread certain ways that are very efficient, it's just really hard to just completely stop and completely prevent them. We want to mitigate them so they don't kill people, so they don't put people in the hospital, and hopefully so we can slow the spread. But we may never stop the spread. We may never make the virus ever go away, but maybe that's okay. We can learn, we learn to live with all kinds of viruses that are around us. But the question is, can we mitigate the serious risks from them?
You're listening to Stats and Stories, and we're talking with Jeff Morris about vaccine effectiveness and countering misleading information related to the use of vaccines. You know, one question is, why has there been such a pushback against vaccines, particularly recently?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think that over time, there's always been, you know, groups of people that have been vaccine skeptics and wondering whether there's too many vaccines or whether vaccines are causing damage that's not being acknowledged. And I think that's been around for decades. But I think the pandemic really helped that to gain much more support and maybe become more mainstream in some ways and really take off. So I think some of the issues we were talking about related to people, you know, being upset about the government response during the pandemic, like first the strict mitigation, and then with the vaccines that people were concerned about, maybe, you know, people feeling like they weren't being transparent about explaining everything that was known and unknown about the vaccine. And then when there's something like mandates and vaccine passports where people feel forced to take it when they're not comfortable, that raises the emotion. And I think that contributed to a lot of concern about the COVID vaccines. And I think a lot of people during the pandemic would say, look, I'm not anti-vaccine. You know, I support all the other vaccines, but I'm just anti-COVID vaccine. But what's kind of interesting is I think a subset of people that became disillusioned with COVID vaccines have sort of progressed in the last couple years to being skeptical and concerned maybe about all vaccines or at least a larger class of vaccines. And I think a lot of that has naturally come out of some of the dynamics of the pandemic. But then I think also with RFK, who's really spent the last couple decades as, you know, kind of a crusader in some ways, again, you know, about potential vaccine harms through the Children's Health Defense Organization. As he became the director of HHS, I think that's again brought these ideas more into the mainstream of the current administration and for a large part of the public. And then some of the changes that we've seen going on are continuing to raise these questions and make changes. So I think that in some ways, these ideas have become connected to certain political groups and political viewpoints, so that those people will now look at these ideas in a different way and perhaps lend more credence to them. So that's where I think, you know, so I think all of those dynamics together, but I think the pandemic definitely played a role in sort of helping these ideas grow and take root in more people.
You have an article with the American Journal of Epidemiology that was examining some of the hot takes and fallacies that were circulating in relation to COVID-19 vaccines and vaccine effectiveness. And as you're talking about this and sort of the political figures that are pushing this kind of worldview around vaccines, I wonder what your thoughts are, because at the same time, social media has become this very potent space where myths and narratives and ideas get spread really widely, and often, you know, a misguided take on something can go viral even as people try to correct it. And I wonder how much of a problem is social media when it comes to trying to communicate about vaccine effectiveness and sort of mitigate some of these more vaccine skeptic views?
Yeah, no, I think it's a big thing. And I think social media is a big part of it. But I think it's even broader than social media that, like, if we think back historically, like, I'm a Gen Xer. And as I grew up, we had like three channels on TV, and you had the news there, and you had your local paper. You didn't even have USA Today when I was a kid. And so everybody was getting the same news, and we'd have different views, but we were all seeing the same things, whether it was complete or the full story, you know, people could question, but we were seeing the same thing. But over time, the internet made all this information available on social media, and now AI gets to know who you are, and for marketing purposes, gives you what you want to hear. So it really just exacerbates sort of the polarization and creates these enormous echo chambers where people get fed information that the bots think is what you want to hear. And so what that tends to do is it can give people a distorted sense of reality, because everything they see is reinforcing their view. And the things that contradict their views, they don't tend to see as much. And so I think it leads to greater polarization just more broadly, even outside of this issue of vaccines. But then when it comes to these questions about vaccines, I think it's a tremendous problem, because a lot of people have legitimate questions, like me included, when they were especially when they were first approved. And I definitely have some genuine critiques. I see that there are genuine risks. So I think in that environment where there's other people that want to take it much further, then it creates a ripe environment for people to make claims that are maybe even very dramatic, maybe untrue, but they'll still gain a tremendous following and get forwarded on social media and spread. And then a lot of people will tend to believe it because it's reinforcing their doubts. So yeah, so I think that's a huge problem. And honestly, that's kind of what got me involved to get more involved in social media during the pandemic. That first I just did some social media posts, but then I created a blog, coviddatascience.com. And that was really my goal, was to try and use my expertise as a biomedical scientist and statistician to evaluate the emerging evidence using the data and the emerging studies, and to critically assess them using scientific principles, and try and put out reliable information about what the data shows. And then as part of that, to counter claims that I think are not supported by the data. And so that was part of my goal, to try and, you know, get into that space and raise questions and try and help people to look more carefully at these things they're believing and seeing, does the data really support this claim that you're believing and forwarding?
You know, so one of the things that struck me with some of the writing that you've done is the how often you'll see that studies are essentially misinterpreted, that basically people are saying, look, the data shows you that the more people that are vaccinated, the more deaths you observe in that community. But that's kind of a naive assessment, because it's not really controlling for factors or other things that someone that knows something about good study design and analysis would be sensitive to. Could you talk through at least an example or two where that occurred and how you kind of deconstruct kind of this false argument?
Yeah, sure. And the big picture of this, that, and this is what's really tricky with the public, is that sometimes what seems very simple and intuitive and clear is wrong.
Yeah.
And the truth is more nuanced. But then because of the distrust, when someone tries to explain the nuance, it sounds like they're double talking and trying to cover up what is plainly true. And I think that dynamic makes it tricky. But yeah, I mean, a lot of stuff, very well-meaning people, very intelligent people misinterpreted a lot of what we saw. And again, we're in sort of an open data age and an open internet age. So all this data is available, which is great. But that also means that people will do naive summaries and make claims, and it will get forwarded. So I know there were a couple examples that led to blog posts that I did that I think kind of went viral themselves. But one of them was like in in summer of 2021, where the vaccines had been out about 6 months, there were reports that about 60% of the hospitalized COVID patients were vaccinated. And so people were saying, well, therefore the vaccines can't be working. Like 60%, that's more than half. So the vaccinated are worse off. And so when I saw this, Israel had shared this data on the web, and indeed it was true. 60% of those that were currently hospitalized infections were vaccinated. But then when I looked at the data more carefully, we saw that 80% of the adults in Israel were fully vaccinated at that time point. So when you actually then compute the infection, the severe infection rate in the vaccinated and unvaccinated, actually the vaccinated had a 67% lower rate of hospitalized COVID infections than the unvaccinated. So the 60% made it look like the vaccinated were worse, but actually they were, as an entire group, 2/3 better. So that's something called the base rate fallacy, where if you compare two groups and one group is much bigger, then if you just look at the actual number of events, the group that is bigger looks like it's doing worse, even if its rate of that event is much lower. So that was what was going on. But then there was even something more subtle there, because from what we were hearing, 67% lower risk would be very disappointing. We expected something more like 90% at that time, based on what we were being told and what some other data showed. But what's interesting is that's all vaccinated across all age groups. And so Israel had split it into those under 50 and those over 50. And the older people were simply more vaccinated. So over 90% of the older people were vaccinated, and more than 80% of the unvaccinated were in the younger group. So if you just split the groups into the younger and older and computed the severe COVID rate, then actually in the younger people, they were 85% less likely to have severe COVID. The older people were 92% less likely to have severe COVID if they were vaccinated. So what initially looked like it was saying the people in the vaccinated group did worse, looked like, if anything, there was a strongly protective effect, perhaps even 90% reduced risk. And so that's an example of age confounding and even something really subtle called Simpson's paradox. So when I did a post on this, and this was my first post that went viral, got downloaded almost 1 million times, and newspapers in the next day after I posted it, in Italy, in Spain, and in Germany, their main newspapers printed an article on my blog post talking about this, because people were wondering how this could be true. And then I got a lot of people that have told me they use this as an example of Simpson's paradox, because people were really perplexed about the 60%. But when you break it down, even in a very basic way, you can see how people would misinterpret the data.
So, you know, this idea of breaking out of echo chambers and using the scientific method and kind of testing what you believe, these are all really important messages. If you're going to advise the public to kind of be more critical consumers of claims, do you have a piece of advice or two you might share?
That's a good question. I mean, I think it depends on context, because I think there's a lot of potholes. But one thing that I really emphasize in my own communications is observational data. It's really hard to draw causal conclusions from observational data. So when you see observational data, you have to be very, very careful. And you can't, what looks like a really simple summary and is really intuitive to you can be completely wrong. And you might draw the total opposite wrong conclusion. And it's difficult and subtle. And so that's my biggest warning, is to just be cautious about that. And then in some of my, you know, blog posts, and now I've switched more to Twitter, X, doing things, but I try to highlight some of the things I see over and over again to try and help the people that follow me or see my posts be able to recognize it on their own. And I think to some degree, there's some success in that, because I see people raising these concerns on their own, saying, oh no, this is Simpson's paradox, or oh no, this is base rate fallacy. So I think it helps a little bit.
All right, well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Sure, thank you. Appreciate it.
Stats and Stories is a partnership between the American Statistical Association and Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film. You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or other places you can find podcasts. If you'd like to share your thoughts on our program, send your email to statsstories@amstat.org or check us out at statsandstories.net. Be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.